I got him down to 9. He'll take the 7 today, and you can pay the balance in installments of $20 a month for 10 months. He agreed to waive the interest.
How on earth did you manage that?
He's got his eye on my Packard. Worth his while to keep me happy. The Buick begins to shimmy at 65, so I wouldn't take it over 60.
Grace laughs. I'll be amazed if I ever go over 35.
After I made the deal, I got him to agree to fill the oil in the radiator and gas her up. As soon as we do the paperwork, we can go get that cup of coffee.
I'm buying you lunch, she says. They both order meals that will take them 20 minutes to eat.
I told him we'd be back in half an hour.
Grace nods. Now, alone with a doctor in the luncheonette, an awkwardness settles over her. Her mouth is dry. She isn't at all certain she can call him John. He sits back in the booth and lights a cigarette and asks her if she wants one. She says yes, mainly to quell her nerves. If they were in the office right now, there wouldn't be any nerves. It's the change of venue and possibly the excitement of buying her own car that's causing her anxiety.
You're smiling, he says.
I was thinking about Rosie. I told you about her. She almost always makes me smile.
Why is that?
She's a little zany, and she wants to have fun. If she were still living next door, and I drove up with a new Buick, she'd shriek with happiness. She'd want to put all our kids in the back seat and go for a ride and let our hair blow in the wind and smoke cigarettes.
You must miss her.
I do. He puts money on the table. No, it's my treat, she says.
Okay, he says, withdrawing the cash.
Grace fetches 75 cents from her purse.
He stands. Let's go take your new car for a spin. I'll leave mine here. You're driving.
Having adjusted the seat so that it suits her, she maneuvers out of the city. The doctor leans back. Where shall I go? She asks.
Get us out of the city, and then take Route 9 again, he says. We'll head toward Kennebunkport.
She follows his directions.
Now bring it up to 35, he instructs.
I don't want to get a ticket my first time out.
You won't.
Grace brings it up to speed and lets the Buick go. She's too nervous to turn on the radio or the heater. Her hands feel as though they're cemented onto the steering wheel.
Take it to 40.
Speeding tickets are expensive.
I know, trust me. How does it feel?
Good. He laughs.
You're supposed to be thrilled.
I'm too nervous to be thrilled.
I can see that. Here.
He holds out a lit cigarette. Grace reluctantly lets go of the wheel to take it, and then again when she wants a puff.
Now hit 55, he says, and roll down your window.
She holds the steering wheel with her right hand, which has a cigarette in it, and rolls her window down. The cold air blasts into the car and lifts her hair.
Relax, he says. Smoke your cigarette, let your hair blow around, and think of Rosie.
When they reach the town limits of Kennebunkport, Grace reverses direction and heads back to Biddeford.
Wait a sec, John says, reaching into his coat pocket. I wrote down 2 addresses from this morning's paper for apartments that sounded promising. How about you come with me? I could use your opinion.
Grace imagines telling her mother that it takes a very long time to buy a car. The first place was clearly once a boarding house with its bare door and at least 6 vehicles parked in the driveway. The building is painted sky blue, the shutters pink, and there are rusted farm implements and children's toys in the front yard.
What do you think? Grace asks.
Worth a try? John raises his eyebrows.
I don't think I could stand coming home to a pink and blue house. And to judge from all the stuff in the yard, I'm guessing the interior isn't up to much either.
If it were me, Grace says, I wouldn't go inside.
That's it then, he says, and gives her directions to the second place.
Grace pulls to a stop at the head of a driveway. It's hard to tell if it's a working farm or not. The buildings are well kept. They are presented with three doors to choose from.
Pretty barn, Grace murmurs.
John heads for the main house.
This must be the kitchen door. With farm folk, that usually means the front door because the real front door is never opened.
How do you know so much about farms?
When I was in medical school, a doctor let me go with him on house calls.
John knocks, and the middle-aged woman, with her hair in a bun and her face red, heat from the oven, Grace decides, opens the door.
Hello, we're here to see about the apartment to rent, John explains.
Yep, the woman says, stepping aside. Grace would like to rent the kitchen. The scent of sweet spices floods the room. She breathes deeply.
It's this way, the farm woman says, opening another door.
Grace has a sense that they're now in the L attached to the kitchen.
This used to be a sheep farm. Last October, when the sheep were out to the far pasture, fire come roaring down the hill like a dragon and burnt nearly all of them. They couldn't get away. You could smell cooked meat for weeks. That's why we're renting out rooms, to make ends meet.
The fire didn't touch the house, Grace says.
Nope.
You were lucky.
Don't feel that way.
She stops and makes a short gesture with her hand.
This is it.
Grace scans the room, large enough for a small sofa, an armchair, a table, and two chairs. The woman has made an effort to transform what was essentially a place for tools into a cozy living room. The focal point is the fireplace. When the farm wife notices Grace's glance, she says,
"Fireplace draws good. I only put a hot plate out here in case you want to make your own coffee. You always have access to the kitchen, and I make three meals a day. They're included in the rent. You can eat with one of us or bring your meal to the table here. As we go along, you can give me some idea of what you'd like. You planning on having children?"
Grace and John look at each other.
"We're not married," John says. "Grace is my sister, and I'm John Lightheart," he says, offering his hand. "Pardon my manners. I should have introduced us right away. Only I will be renting the apartment."
"I mentioned it because I don't rent to families. In the next room there, you'll find the bed in the bathroom. Water pressure is good. It's got electric heat, but you get too cold, just build up the fire with the wood."
The apartment comes with a porch that faces out to pasture. Grace wanders into the bedroom as John emerges. There's a white iron bed, a white bureau, fresh yellow and white striped wallpaper, a desk, and two more windows. A closet has been made by a curtain pulled across an alcove. She checks the bathroom. Old, but clean. Well kept. Plenty of linens. When she exits the bedroom, John blocks her way.
"What do you think?"
he asks in a low tone.
"I like it. The shared meals, I don't know."
"It's perfect. I can't cook, and I haven't the time to do it."
"You've certainly got a lot of scenery. Four big windows. If I were you, I'd take it. Make the lease flexible in case the husband is intolerable."
She turns around.
"Yes, this suits you. And look, it has bookshelves. You'll get the cooking smells since it's attached to the kitchen. Eventually, you'll have to tell them that you're a doctor and have long hours. But I'd take it," she says.
"One good turn deserves another," he says. "You followed my advice, I'll follow yours."
Dr. Lightheart moves toward the farm wife.
"I think I'll take it," he says, "if we can work out terms." It's $65 a month with meals, heat, hot water, electric, and laundry included. Rent due the first of the month. We live our life the way we live our life. You'll hear sounds from the kitchen, I don't doubt, and the cars coming and going, but the walls are as solid as can be. The house was built in 1720, this L in 1790.
built as a passageway from the barn to the house. Man was supposed to get hisself clean before he come into the kitchen. I don't like a dirty kitchen, and my mother didn't either.
Well, can we just assume this is the first of the month?
The doctor asks, counting out the bills for the farm woman. You moving in today? She asks.
I thought I might. I don't have much.
What's your living?
I'm a doctor. I work in a clinic in North Kennebunkport.
She nods, taking this in. You'll be wanting supper tonight.
Yes, if you have enough. What time is dinner?
5, on the dot.
Ah, says the doctor. The earliest I can get here during the week would be 7. 6:30 on a slow day.
Well then, I'll save your dinner for you. I can always whip up another batch of popovers if they go flat.
I'll be here for dinner tonight at 5, and tomorrow at 5, he says, shaking the farm wife's hand.
Grace smiles at the woman as she follows John out to the driveway. They don't speak right away, thinking it rude to do so in full view of the wife. In the car, however, Grace says, You just got yourself a good deal. She doesn't seem like the type to want to pry into your life. I liked the place. It was charming, and in the spring it will be magnificent.
You paint a nice picture.
When they reach Biddeford, Grace double parks beside his Packard. He lingers in her car a second longer than he might.
Maybe we could go on another drive next weekend, take the kids sledding. I know a great hill.
That sounds like fun.
Great day, Grace, he says as he leaves the Buick.
When Grace pulls up the driveway in the navy blue Buick, her mother pushes the back door open.
Oh my Jesus Christ Almighty!
She exclaims and holds her chest as if she thought her heart might explode.
Are you angry? Grace asks, sliding out of the car.
Angry? Oh, no.
In the doorframe, her mother stands in awe, as if her chariot had come for her, as if all the dates of her youth had shown up at the right moment, just when her hair is perfect. Grace's responsibilities at the clinic expand. She is asked to see to the billing of patients and to keep the accounts at the bank. When the waiting room is overcrowded, she is charged with bringing patients to rooms in which she takes their temperature, weighs them, gives them a robe if necessary, and records physical complaints. In this way, the patients can wait in a private room for Dr. Lightheart. By midweek, she asks the doctor if there's enough money in the budget to buy side tables and lamps and to subscribe to Time and Life. She wants to make the waiting room more appealing.
Sure, Dr. Lightheart says. Saturday afternoon all right with you? I could leave right after lunch, say 1 o'clock.
Surprised that he has invited himself along, she tells him she'll just check with her mother.
Your car or mine?
I'll collect you.
Grace can't have Dr. Lightheart come calling for her at Merle's house. Grace invents an outing for her mother and the children for Sunday, a car trip with a picnic to a scenic vista. After explaining the trip, to her mother's pleasure, she mentions that she'll need a couple of hours on Saturday afternoon to buy furniture for the office.
Not new furniture, her mother exclaims.
I'll find a good second-hand store. It's just side tables. They have to be respectable and more or less match the chairs there.
What's that, then?
Wood with a mahogany-like stain.
And to think I used to have side tables that would have been perfect, muses her mother.
I wouldn't have taken your tables.
Maybe you should get a coffee table, too, her mother suggests, to put flowers on.
We're getting subscriptions to Time and Life.
Well, you'd better get good housekeeping.
On Friday night, wanting to confirm their expedition the next day, Grace leans against the doorframe of Dr. Lightheart's office. He hands her a check.
So we're all set for tomorrow? He asks.
Yes. How do you like your new place?
Meals are outstanding. There's a widow living in one of the bedrooms upstairs in the main house, a shoe salesman in another. I gather he's giving her samples.
He wiggles his eyebrows, and Grace laughs.
I'm not there much. Heat's surprisingly good. Bed's comfy.
The bed must indeed be comfortable because the doctor appears, for the first time since she met him, rested. Maybe another weekend at his apartment will be even more beneficial. For her part, Grace can't imagine living alone. Sometimes she wants to picture it, but to do so would mean obliterating Claire and Tom.
I've heard of two places we can try, Grace suggests.
And there's always Salvation Army.
They must be cleaned out by now, she says. On Saturday morning, in Merle's room, Grace hems a pale wool skirt she wants to wear on the shopping trip. Sunlight, bouncing off the snow, makes the windows shimmer, but the glare darkens objects in the room. She tries on the skirt and stands before the mirror. Because her hair hangs straight from the winter dry, she decides to put it up in a French twist, maybe a little lipstick to punctuate her facial pallor. The skirt is part of a suit from Merle's closet and still loose, though more tailoring would leave the garment misshapen. She puts her hands on her hips, turns, and notes that she's gaining back some of the weight she lost when Aiden was in the house. Her hands move up her ribcage to the undersides of her breasts, but she can feel almost nothing through the thick brassiere and her white blouse. It's the same with her girdle. Running her hands down the front of her skirt, she would never know of the contours within. The scream is so loud, so guttural, so not like a child's, and yet a child's, that Grace yells Claire's name as she runs downstairs and into the kitchen. First she sees the terrible apparition, and then, in the corner, her mother holding Tom with Claire's face buried in her skirt. Claire has wet her overalls. In a voice as calm as she can manage, Grace tells her mother to take the children upstairs. When she turns to her husband, it's all she can do to stand straight and not cover her mouth. He is hideous. The left side of his face seems still to be on fire, with its skin resembling a gruesome picture in a medical textbook. His ear is gone, his scalp raw, and his left eye appears to have melted. His right eye and his mouth are mostly normal, though the left corner of his lip is indistinct. He wears a silk scarf around his neck, and she realizes that the arm of his tattered coat is empty. She can't imagine what the skin on his torso looks like. "Are you in pain?" she asks, her first words to her husband.
"Yes."
"What can I do for you?" He tries to shake his good arm out of his coat, and she understands. He wants his coat off. Without looking at his face, she begins to lower the empty sleeve from his shoulder. He yelps. She must have touched him too hard. She lets the coat fall to the ground, then picks it up and drapes it over the back of a chair. "Sit," she gestures, staring at the pinned sleeve.
"Can't sit."
"Can you lie down?" she asks. He nods.
"I need water."
She pours a glass of water at the sink and hands it to him. He raises it to his mouth, and at least half of it dribbles down the left side of his face and falls onto his shirt, made of an unusually thin material.
"Come with me," she says.
The irony of Grace leading her husband to another room in his boyhood house is not lost on her, and can't be on him. Her hands shaking, she checks her watch. An hour before she is to collect Dr. Lightheart, which will not happen now. She doesn't know the telephone number at the farm, and she isn't sure she ever gave him the number of Merle's house. How long will he wait before he realizes she's not coming? Would he then dare to drive to her house? She prays that he won't. She points to the sofa. In what looks to be a torturous set of moves, Jean manages to lie on his right side. She finds a pillow and puts it under his head. As she backs away from him, the entire construct of her life collapses. She will live in this house with this injured man on the couch until one of them dies. She will never again go to a job. She will never make love again. She will not have friends. Slowly, she sinks into the armchair under the tremendous weight of her future. Jean.
I have to go to Claire and Tom, Grace says to Jean.
He barely moves his head. He has an inner look she's familiar with from the clinic. The anticipation of pain. She finds her family upstairs in her bedroom. Grace walks first to Claire and holds her in a tight embrace.
You were scared, weren't you?
She asks her daughter, whose clothes have been changed. Claire, sucking her thumb, nods.
Do you remember Daddy?
Claire gives a more exaggerated nod.
Well, Daddy went to help others on the night of the fire, and he got burned. What you just saw was Daddy with some burns on him.
Claire drops the thumb and opens her eyes as wide as they will go. She stares into the middle distance, caught halfway between fear and incomprehension.
He was a hero, your Daddy, and sometimes heroes come back with cuts and bumps on them. That's what happened to him.
She sets Claire on her lap so that she can see her daughter more easily.
Would you like to go out and see him? He's lying down.
No!
Claire keens as she whips her head from side to side. Tom, crawling on the bedspread, stops to listen to his sister.
That's all right, says Grace, holding her daughter close and rubbing her back.
Grace catches her mother's eye, in which she reads an agitated mix of fear, despair, and stoicism.
We need to make some decisions, Grace says.
Is he staying?
We'll have to put him in the library. I'm not sure he can make it upstairs.
The police said he'd been in a coma. Came to a week ago in a New Hampshire hospital, but couldn't remember his name until yesterday.
How is Claire?
Jean asks from the couch as Grace sits across from him.
She's fine, says Grace. She just needs a little time is all.
My own children didn't recognize me.
I'm sorry, she says.
Don't be. It's reality.
He swivels his good eye, taking in the room.
I was never allowed in here. My bedroom and the kitchen were my playrooms. I was brought in here only to meet company and then disappear.
I'm sorry.
I wish you wouldn't keep saying that. What are you doing here?
Grace crosses her arms in front of her chest.
Here? In this house? Our own house burned down.
So I'm told. But my mother's house?
Your children were homeless. My mother, too. I didn't have a choice.
She pauses.
Were you in a coma?
I didn't know who I was until a week after I woke up. For that week, I didn't want to be alive.
She waits.
The arm, but mostly the pain.
Why did they take your arm? She asks. Unable to look away from the pinned sleeve.
Gangrene.
Oh, Jean, tell me what I need to know in order to take care of you.
He closes his eye.
You won't want to do it. I'm going to need some things.
Such as?
Gauze, Vaseline, iodine, a bedpan.
He studies her.
Lots of towels. The sheets will need to be cleaned every day. A rubber sheet.
Grace takes in a sharp breath.
I told you you wouldn't like it.
We'll do whatever has to be done.
And aspirins. I get terrible headaches. Where are you sleeping?
On the second floor.
In my mother's bed?
Grace nods. He glances at Grace's skirt.
And if I'm not mistaken, you're wearing her clothes.
We had nothing when we got here.
Fluid leaks from inside Jean's shirt. She leaves the room, finds a clean towel, returns, and lays it with care over his left side.
"I'm sorry if I'm hurting you," she says. "Please don't pity me."
"I don't." But she does.
"You lost the baby," he says.
"I did."
"Was it bad?"
"It happened the night of the fire." He rolls his head to the side. For a moment, Grace wonders if he will cry. But no, he's angry.
"If only they'd let us go home, I'd have got you out of there."
"Can you lie here for half an hour?" she asks.
"You're leaving me?"
"Just to get a doctor."
"Old man Franklin?"
"He's gone. His house burned down, so he retired. We have a new one now. His name is Dr. Lightheart." For a few seconds, Gene is silent. Then he snaps his fingers.
"Injun," he says.
"What?"
"Injun. You can always tell from the name. Two names put together. White man, yellow hair, many goats, watchman. I knew some of them in the war, and later working on the pike."
The prominent cheekbones, the high color of his skin, the straight black hair. Indian and something else. Maybe a lot of something else. What difference does it make? "He's a good doctor," Grace says. Grace's hands shake so much she can barely shift the gears. Backing down the hill, she veers into snow-covered bushes at the end. "I'll kill myself this way," she thinks. When she turns onto the rural street on which the farmhouse is located and pulls to the top of the drive, John Lightheart is pacing. She's a half hour late for their appointment.
"Hello,"
he says with a grin as he swings open the passenger door and gets in. Grace turns to him and holds up a hand.
"John."
She pauses, gathers herself. "My husband, Gene, came back this morning. He's badly burned and not yet healed. He can't sit. If you're willing, I need you to come to the house and examine him and tell me what to do." The doctor searches her eyes.
"Are you all right? Your face is white."
"It's just the shock."
"You shouldn't be driving, but I'd better take my car. You go on and I'll catch up. I have to put a few things in my bag."
"Thank you," says Grace. "Please don't mention that I work for you. I haven't told him yet, and I'm not sure I'll be able to continue at the clinic."
"That would be a shame."
"He's crude. He's not himself."
"You go back to him. I'll be right behind you."
Grace parks the car and reluctantly walks into Merle's house. Her mother, with a yellow apron on, stands in the center of the kitchen.
"I don't know what to make for him to eat," she sputters.
"The doctor is coming. I nearly fainted when the police showed up. It's dreadful, isn't it?" The sharp light from the window etches every defect in Jean's face. Grace partially draws the maroon drapes.
"Where did you get that schmancy Buick?"
he asks. "A friend lent it to me."
"Rosie?"
"Another friend. Rosie and Tim have moved to Nova Scotia. Can you walk with me to the library? There's a bed in there."
"Why?"
he asks. "We had a power outage that lasted 4 days. We all slept in there with the fire going." She watches as he reverses the agonizing process that enabled him to lie down. She moves toward him to help. But he limps ahead of her, indicating that he's master of the house now. Grace greets Dr. Lightheart at the back door without a word. She remembers how Dr. Franklin used to walk in unannounced and take the stairs to the bedroom where the patient lay. Another world. Another country. "Jean, this is Dr. Lightheart," she says, introducing her husband.
"You can leave us alone, Mrs. Holland," says the doctor. Grace closes the door. Mrs. Holland.
She sits on an upholstered chair in the hallway that may as well have been placed here for this very purpose,
to wait to be summoned. In less than 2 hours, her life has been transformed. To think that at this very minute she might have been selecting side tables and lamps for the office with a nice man, a good man. She was planning on purchasing something quirky or useful for him as a house present. She hears murmurs, a quick stab of a cry, and then silence behind the closed door. Dr. Lightheart signals to Grace to move with him toward the sitting room.
"The burns are bad," he says as they walk. "He'll need constant care. He has to wear loose silk pajamas and lie on silk sheets and silk pillowcases, all of which will have to be laundered every day. I've treated the burns, but I've not put on gauze. I want them to dry in the air under the pajamas I brought."
He pauses.
"I'll see what I can come up with and send along with Amy. I've left the supplies he'll need for the next day or two on the dresser. Amy will bring more. The most important thing at the moment is to keep the wounds clean and to keep him hydrated. Whenever you're with him, make him drink. Water, apple juice, and more water. I'd put a small table right next to the bed and set a plate of finger food on it. He can manage that better than, say, soup. He'll pick at it when he wants to. Amy will try to get him to sit up tomorrow. She'll be firm, and I expect your husband will holler like crazy. Then you'll have to continue with that treatment yourself if you're physically capable."
He sighs.
"Grace, it's unfair, I know. I'd like to see you hire a part-time nurse. Full-time would be better."
She shakes her head. "He'd want to know how I was paying for it."
"You have more jewelry,"
he says in a lower voice.
"I don't know. He's very sharp. I noticed that.
I'm sorry about not being able to work for you. I loved the job.
And I was happy to have you there. Truly."
As they head for the back door, he collects his hat and pulls a piece of paper from his pocket.
"This is the phone at the farm. Call me anytime. If I can't get here myself, I'll send someone. Below that is the number of the ambulance service. An emergency would be pain terrible enough that he can't keep from crying out for, say, 15 minutes. Excessive oozing from the wounds, any sign of blood from the wounds, and fever. I can't do anything for his headache today, because I don't yet understand what's causing it. It might just be dehydration."
"Thank you for coming. You've been a good friend to me."
"I hope we'll continue to be good friends."
He puts his hand on her shoulder before he turns the doorknob.
"I want to feel sorry for the man."
The doctor has left a glass with a bent straw on the mahogany dresser so that Jean, in new navy silk pajamas, can drink water without sitting up. She notices that he has given himself a sponge bath in the bathroom nearby. The good part of his face looks shinier, and his nails are clean.
"Was someone here?" he asks.
At first, she thinks his brain is addled. "The doctor was here."
"No, I mean before."
"I don't understand." She sets a small blue plate with pieces of deviled ham sandwich and apple on it by the bedside table.
"I saw a razor blade on the floor of the bathroom, half hidden by the claw foot of the tub. I couldn't bend to pick it up. Someone could cut a foot on it."
"I'll get it later," she says.
"But who left it there?"
"I have no idea."
"Well, some man was here. My father's been dead for years."
"Jean, honestly, how would I know?" She pulls a chair closer to the bed. Her husband doesn't smell as bad as he did before the doctor came. "Do you need a toothbrush?" she asks.
"I need it all."
She holds the straw to his lips. After Grace has played cowboys and Indians at Claire's request, she returns to Jean's room and sees him struggling to get out of bed. "Here, let me help," she says,
She lifts the blanket and sheet away from him. He pushes himself off the bed with his right hand. There are stains on the sheets.
"What do you want?" she asks.
"What do I want?" he says when standing. "I want to be a normal human being again. I want to go back to work. I'd like to take a shit in a toilet. I'd like to sit at a table and eat a bowl of soup. I'd like to not have to worry about moving in a certain way and causing pain. I'd like my face back. That enough?"
Jean's bitterness, however well-earned, could eat through walls. He says he wants to walk into the parlor because he's sure he left something there. Again, he moves ahead, and Grace obediently follows.
"There," he says. "I knew something was wrong."
"What is it?"
"Why's the piano in here?" he asks.
She glances at the piano, gathering dust. Grace has no choice but to lie and lie and lie.
"I thought it was always in here."
"No, no, no, no. It was on the second floor, in the turret, just off my mother's bedroom."
"Are you sure? Who would put a piano on the second floor?" she asks.
"For crying out loud, I should know. I took lessons on it for years. I know this house a lot better than you do."
"Of course," she says.
The business with the bedpan is awful. He tells her how to prop him up with pillows under his head and back and knees, and to put the pan under him, and to go away and close the door. Grace does as asked and wants to walk straight out the front door and not stop until she falls down. The sight of her children as she puts them to bed is a flicker of joy in a dim cave. She gathers them around her on the floor and sings a dozen verses of "Hush, Little Baby," making up the lyrics as she goes along. From the corner of her eye, she sees her mother scurry about folding laundry and picking up toys. Grace sings until the children feel heavier in her lap, and with her mother's help, she carries them to their beds. She would like to lie down on the floor between the children and have her mother float a blanket over her. Amy arrives at the house with an enormous green suitcase full of supplies. For the first time, Grace sees the extent of Jean's burns along his torso and hip and upper thigh. Her gorge rises. Keeping up a constant chatter, the nurse instructs Grace how to clean the burns, let them air dry, apply iodine or Vaseline where necessary, take his temperature and his blood pressure, examine the skin, bathe the back of his body, and help him dress himself. She leaves a list of instructions next to the supplies.
"Now the hard part," Amy says. He has to stay as flexible as he can without cracking the protective layer of skin he's building up. "That's why I've put the Vaseline on so heavily. Later we'll dab it off." She turns and addresses Jean. "Do you want to be able to sit on a chair?"
"Yes."
"Do you want to be able to get down onto the floor and play with your children?"
"Oh, come on," he says. "What's with the interrogation?"
"I need to know how badly you want these things, Mr. Holland, because if you really, truly want them, you're going to have to work hard."
Grace watches as Amy lays Jean flat on his back in the bed, which already causes him some pain as his left side comes in contact with the sheet. She takes hold of his left leg with one hand on his calf and one on his knee. She bends the knee and pushes it toward his face, in and out, in and out. Jean grits his teeth. Whatever Amy does to one side of Jean's body, she does to the other. She has Jean scoot down on the bed. After he has done so, she climbs onto the bed up by the headboard and asks him to lift his head and shoulders as high as he can. As soon as he rises off the sheet, she gets her arms and her full weight under him and slowly angles him higher and higher until he is nearly at 30 degrees from the flat surface. He cries out and tries to turn and hop off the bed.
"Grace, hold his legs down by the ankles."
Grace leans over the footboard and pins her husband's feet to the bedspread. When Jean's cries reach a certain pitch, Amy lets him rest. Grace hopes her mother is on the third floor with the children and the door shut.
"Good work, Mr. Holland," she says. "We'll rest a minute and give that another try."
"The hell you will."
"Do you want to be able to sit on a toilet one day and get rid of the bedpan? Because really, that is what this is all about. You getting back your independence. So do you want that?"
"I guess so."
"No, I'm serious, Mr. Holland. Do you really want that to happen?"
"Jesus Christ,"
he says in a louder voice. "Then bend your head and shoulders as far up as they will go, and we'll give this another try." Without being told to, Grace grabs her husband's ankles while Amy repeats the process. Grace knows she'll never be able to do this therapy for Jean, both because she can't hold his feet and push from behind at the same time, and because she doesn't have Amy's strength. After the third exercise, Jean says to Grace,
"Get that bitch out of here."
"You're going to have to toughen up. I don't have your strength. You're afraid of him," Amy says as she puts on her heavy wool coat. "I've always been afraid of him," Grace confesses. "Do you want him on a bedpan the rest of his life? Because if he remains as he is for much longer, he won't be able to sit up ever. It's been way too long as it is." Grace wraps her arms over her head.
"Listen," Amy says.
"You're going to have to find something within you that can do this. It'll take a solid month of misery, and if all goes well, each day will get better and better. Be a drill sergeant now, and later you can love him."
"But I won't," Grace wants to say. "I won't love him."
Grace becomes an unwilling nurse during a string of days that in themselves seem endless. A routine is established. Grace wakes early to prepare Jean's breakfast before he makes his way into the kitchen and eats it standing up. Hard-boiled eggs and toast pieces serve him well. Her mother knows to keep the children upstairs until 7:30, when Grace spirits Jean back into his room or to the sofa in the sitting room. Mindful of his pain and boredom, she tries to carve the day into three separate sections. Mornings, during which she sometimes reads the newspaper to him or lets him lie by himself in the sitting room. Afternoons, which are devoted to physical therapy. For the first several days until she could convince Jean to cooperate, Grace had to call in her mother to hold his feet down, episodes that made her mother cry after she left the room. And evenings, which he spends back in the sitting room with a plate of finger food beside him. Often, Grace joins him. They remain silent while she knits or sews, or he asks her questions. She can hardly comprehend that the room in which she unwillingly sits with her damaged husband is the same place in which she came to love Aiden Byrne. Such utter happiness then, and now such despair. Grace's duties as her husband's nurse and her sense of having lost whatever freedom she once had cause her to be exhausted nearly every evening. When she climbs up to her bedroom, her bedroom now, not Merle's, Grace has at least earned that. She clings to the banister. Her mother's comments that she needs to take better care of herself, that she is letting herself go, that sometimes her clothes aren't even clean, haven't helped. More and more, Marjorie remains on the third floor with the children, descending only to cook lunch and dinner. It has not escaped Grace's notice that her mother is a prisoner, too. Winter hints at spring, not by temperature, but by the quality of the light. The stolen minutes Grace sits huddled in her winter coat on the back steps give her hope. Is she really any worse off than the dispossessed women of Hunts Beach, or than the women who had to nurse injured loved ones back from the war and transform them into husbands?
"We thought if we dug a trench wide enough, we could stop the fire in its tracks," Jean explains,
and Grace nods.
We were stupid. None of us had ever had any experience with fire. We were just following orders from the fire department. The idea was to keep the blaze from reaching town.
He opens his eye.
Can you prop me up again?
Grace lifts his right side so that he is straight up against the back of the sofa, but at a 45-degree angle with pillows behind his shoulders and back. They have to achieve 90 degrees for him to sit in a chair. Beyond that, if he is to get up and out of a chair. The progress is slow, and often there are setbacks.
We'd been digging all day and into the night when we felt an east wind, so we stopped for a break. We thought we were saved. We didn't leave our post, though, because we'd been told to stay put. Can you put that extra pillow there behind my neck?
Grace stands and maneuvers the pillow until he nods.
We were pretty sure a truck would be coming for us with food and coffee, if not a lift back to our homes. And one by one, we began to sit on rocks or against tree stumps, and I remember that I dozed off. I woke to shouting.
As Grace had, with Claire's cries.
When I stood, the fire had crested Merzerv Hill and was roaring its way down to us. Balls of fire tumbled down the hill, hitting trees, missing others, and the wind behind the fire was ferocious. I remember thinking that fire was really pink and red, not orange. Within minutes, we could feel the heat and see animals running around us for safety. Two of the men ran with the animals. The others stayed with me. Then I felt Jack dragging on my sleeve and shouting at me to go with him, to get out. I shook my head. I had another idea. I could see that behind the wall of fire, the earth was black. The fire traveled that fast. Tim and Jack dug holes in the ground, knowing they couldn't outrun the blaze. When it got too close to Bear, I saw a space about the length of a truck and ran through it as fast as I could. My mistake was not having something to cover my head. I felt intense heat and knew my sleeve and hair had caught fire. I panicked and stumbled and tried to put out the flames by slapping them. I fell onto my left side, the ground so hot I couldn't bear the pain. And then I fainted.
I'm so sorry, Grace says. No other words will do. The crocuses emerge, purple and white, and are soon joined by the bright yellow of daffodils and forsythia. As she explores the gardens, Grace's spirits are buoyed by the greening lawn, the buds on the fruit trees, and the stalks of tulips breaking the soil. After the winter months, the soil will produce a bounty of surprises with flowers blooming every day or every week, small gifts for Grace. She will see the buds, but won't know their color until days later. She wonders if the lilacs are deep purple or lavender or white. She has no idea what shapes and hues the roses will have. Soon she'll be able to bring in bouquets to freshen the house's stale smell, an odor worse than stale that she suspects emanates from Jean, no matter how much she launders his sheets and clothes. Jean has remembered the name of the insurance company, and even the salesman's name. Grace calls and explains their situation, which is near destitute. But when the claims adjuster comes to the house and looks around, he's reluctant to discuss benefits. Grace points out that the house is not theirs, they have no money for food or clothes, that Jean can't work, and the enormous tank of fuel oil is empty. Should they have a series of cold days, she doesn't know what they would do. In addition, she says in a strong, clear voice, her husband, who was burned in the fire, needs medical attention they can't pay for. When the salesman has the nerve to suggest that she sell some of the obviously expensive pieces of furniture, she raises her voice. Does the adjuster have the paperwork? Yes, he does. Did Jean Holland ever miss a payment? No, he did not. Fine, says Grace. They need the money to build a house, to which they are entitled, and they need additional sums in order to be able to eat and clothe themselves. She is firm, she will not be moved. But it's only when Grace brings the adjuster in to see Jean during a moment when he isn't wearing his eye patch that the adjuster writes her a check for $75 to bridge the gap until another man from the insurance company arrives with a much larger check. One morning, after Grace has made her bed, she stares at the smooth covers, the sheets taut beneath them. She kneels on all fours and pounds her fists into the coverlet. She bangs and slaps until her hands hurt. She stops and looks at her fingers. She tries hard to remember what she felt when she and Jean were courting. There is no other word to describe the decorous study dates and walks into the hills, where occasionally they lay down together. She can't now recall a single word of love. One of them must have said something. On the day they married? Jean grows oddly querulous, as if he, too, were filled with barely concealed rage. One might imagine his anger a result of having met such an odious fate, but Grace suspects his rage has something to do with hers. Jean is as much a prisoner as anyone in the house, more so because of his disabilities. His only outlet is his wife, who cannot take on the burden of his constant pain, his helplessness. One day, when she starts the physical therapy, telling him to raise his head, he refuses.
"No," he says.
"What do you mean, no?" Grace asks.
"I'm not going to do it."
"Just today, or forever?"
"Forever."
"If you stop now, you'll undo all the good that therapy has done you. A year from now, you won't be able to accomplish the simplest thing."
"Maybe not, but you can do it for me, can't you?" he points out.
"You want me to wipe your ass for the rest of your life?" Grace snaps away from Jean, at least as horrified as he by her own revolting question, her cynicism, her anger. But she won't tell him she is sorry. She leaves the room with the realization that her statements to him will get uglier and uglier, that they could so easily spiral out of control. And who would get hurt? The children. Pretty soon, they'll be able to hear what goes on in the library, the sitting room, the kitchen. She puts her forehead to the wall. She doesn't want that for Claire and Tom, for them to have to hunch their shoulders at a raised voice, to have to pretend not to hear an obscenity, to want to absent themselves from their parents, which in time will mean not wanting to be in the house. She has done a good job with the children so far, especially with her mother's help. But she doesn't know if she has the self-discipline to keep it up. Grace thinks of hiring a day nurse, which would free at least 8 hours to be with the kids. If she could manage it, she'd hire a live-in nurse so that she would see her husband in the way the children do, during light-hearted visits. And though she can afford to hire such people, Jean will want to know where the money has come from. Since they have received only $75 from the claims adjuster, he will quickly figure out that she is selling items from the house to pay for the nurses. She doubts he knows about the jewelry, unless Merle often wore it in his presence. Still, he would needle Grace, and life would become even more impossible than it is. She might one day hit him, a thought that appalls her, or simply let him fall to the floor. So easy to do. She has had to catch him when he lost his balance at least a dozen times since he arrived. She takes a deep breath. She can't think these nightmare scenarios.
"Hello, this is Grace Holland. May I speak to Dr. Lightheart?"
"Grace, it's Amy."
"Hi, Amy. Actually, it might be better if I spoke to you."
"Okay."
"I need help."
The statement strikes Grace as true on so many fronts that for a moment she nearly laughs.
"Yes?"
"I need to hire a nurse to come on a daily basis, to help with Jean. I'm having difficulties."
"I thought so. I know of an organization that does just that. Hang on, I've got the number here. But how are you?"
"The truth," Grace thinks.
"At my wit's end."
His care is too much for you. I knew it would be. It's not just that. Things are difficult. It's made taking care of him nearly impossible. How's your health?
My health? I don't even know.
I tell you what, I'll call first thing in the morning and get someone out there straight away. You'll be all right?
Yes. And Amy?
Send someone strong-willed and big. Grace watches as a large woman in a white cap and navy cape emerges from a car that, with its dents and rust, looks as though it's barely survived a military skirmish. There are no pleasantries, hardly enough time to tell Judith, the nurse, the nature of the difficulties she is having with Jean. Grace, trying to keep up with the nurse's long strides, makes it to Jean's door just before Judith does.
"Wait here," Grace says, trying to stop the woman.
"No need to wait. He'll figure it out."
Grace steps away and lingers long enough to hear Judith announce herself and tell Jean that she's been sent to check him out. Not wanting to hear his reply, Grace walks away, but doesn't dare go farther than the sitting room in case the nurse needs her. From time to time, loud sounds emanate from the library bedroom, but she stops herself from investigating. She doesn't want to know. After a time, she climbs the stairs to Merle's closet and retrieves Aiden's letter from the hatbox. When she holds it, she begins to recall the music he once played, but stops short when she discovers that she can't remember certain phrases in their entirety. She presses the letter to her chest. Will time erase the notes that are more precious to her than jewels? She sees vividly the day she met Aiden, and can feel her physical reaction when he played the piano. She recalls being happy, and how she naively thought that state would continue forever. She will buy a record player and fill the house with classical music. The children will appreciate it and remember when Aiden was here, and a time when their mother smiled often. Grace, back in the sitting room, is startled by a door slamming. When she looks up, Judith is standing before her, wiping her hands on a towel.
"I won't be returning," she says.
Grace stands.
"I'm sorry. What happened?"
"I worked him hard, I'll admit that. You probably heard the shouting. And for my troubles, I got a glob of spit down the front of my uniform."
Grace wants to apologize for her husband, to explain.
"You seem a nice person, but your husband, there's something wrong with him. And I mean more than his burns."
"I'm sorry this has happened to you."
"I don't mind telling you that I don't like leaving you alone with him."
"I'll be fine," Grace says, gathering herself. "He was just furious with me for getting a nurse behind his back."
The nurse peers at Grace.
"Are you aware of how crazy that is? Most men in his situation want to get better."
"Men have pride."
"I've seen pride and stubbornness, yes I have. This is something different."
When Grace goes in to see Jean, she finds a subdued husband.
"I don't need anything," he says in a quiet voice.
The next afternoon, Grace arrives home with a second-hand record player that the salesman in the music store turned on for her so that she could listen to a Mozart record. He didn't need to talk up the quality. Grace could hear it for herself. He helped her select music from Chopin and Brahms, from Beethoven and Bach. Nearly giddy with her purchases, she asks her mother to bring the kids downstairs. Grace plugs in the machine, puts a record on the spindle, and lets the music of Chopin fill the house, a grand salute to her mother and Claire and Tom as they make their way down the staircase. Grace beams at them.
"I've bought a record player. We'll have music now." "It's beautiful," her mother says, putting her hands to her cheeks.
Claire hears the music as her cue to start dancing. Tom holds on to the coffee table and shakes his hips and dips his knees, trying to imitate his sister, which makes Grace and her mother laugh.
Marjorie asks Grace to dance. The pair hold hands, and Grace remembers the silly joy of dancing for Aiden, because neither she nor her mother really knows any steps to this sort of music,